The Tom Woods Show, episode 2302.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. If you read my newsletter, and why wouldn't you? Because of how legendary it is, you can subscribe to it at tomwoods.com. I mentioned something that happened last week at Stanford, and my gosh, the things piling up that are coming out of Stanford. They're just unbelievable. But we're talking about an episode involving a federal judge, in effect, getting shouted down. There's so much disruption, he can barely say what he wants to say. And he wants some administrator to come and take care of it. And, oh, he gets an administrator, all right. But it turns out rather the opposite of the way a civilized person would expect it to. So I'm very happy to have with us today Tim Rosenberger Jr., who is the president of the Federalist Society chapter at Stanford, and who, as a matter of fact, introduced, is it Judge Duncan?
Yes, sir.
Okay, at this event, and I want to talk to Tim a bit about what actually went on and what's happened in the aftermath of this episode. So, Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to talk.
I'd love it if we could first actually have you say a word about the Federalist Society itself. I've had the pleasure of speaking to a number of chapters of it over the years. In fact, I had one day where I spoke at Columbia Law School to a huge crowd of law students. And then that afternoon spoke at Rutgers, both events put together by the Federalist Society. I feel like the Federalist Society is the best effort we can make at equal time, let's say.
That's a very charitable description of us. So thanks. We're technically a nonpartisan group, but we are probably the only diversity of viewpoint at a lot of law schools. And so we bring judges, scholars, practitioners, people who are doing important work in the law, generally who share a common view that the role of the judicial branch is to interpret the law and apply the law rather than to sort of make up the law. So it's generally unified by a restrained view of the judiciary, but not by any particular set of views on any of the issues that would come before judges or affect how we interpret policy.
I remember, at least in the old days when I used to follow the Federalist Society a bit more, they were also keen on having debates. In fact, a couple of the times when I was invited, they would ask me, can you think of some good person who might counter what you're saying so that we can hold a debate? And again, the idea being that we're contributing to a robust exchange of ideas that we might not otherwise have just by having a debate, letting two different perspectives hash it out.
That is always our goal. We like having debates. And in the absence of debate, we like to do responses. So we would invite a judge or a lawyer to come in and talk and then have a professor offer a response. So even if there's not direct adversarial back and forth, we're sort of showing both perspectives. Unfortunately, for the last several years, it's been really hard to get people to come give responses. Almost no one on our faculty will do it. And even if we were willing to look a bit further afield to say to people at area law schools, this is a chance to come speak at Stanford, which we had hoped would be an enticing thing, people will not come and do it.
Now, why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are a couple things. I think that the main one is an organized effort by a number of very prominent people in the legal academy and a number of student activists to sort of anathematize anyone who participates in a Federal Society event. The purported rationale for this was that it stemmed from January 6th, and that after January 6th, too many Federalist Society people had been involved in the Trump administration, and it was therefore imperative to deplatform the Federalist Society and make it seem beyond the bounds of discourse. Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, obviously two sitting senators, have long-time associations with the Society, but it seems like it's probably a bit more nefarious than that, and that by deplatforming the Federalist Society, you really can stifle the primary counter-programming at law schools, and they can operate more like seminaries, and that there's one set of viewpoints, and they're presented, and anything else is a heresy.
That was more or less what I expected your answer to be, which is why back when, I guess I was more involved in terms of giving talks and things at the Federal Society 10, 15 years ago, it's amazing how quickly things have changed. Just in that amount of time, the level of discourse and the nastiness is so different now than it was then. I mean, yeah, obviously the Federalist Society had its enemies and critics, but it wasn't anything like what we see today on the campuses. I would think an academic career these days would be much more challenging than it was, as I say, not even a generation ago.
You say that, it's really funny. We were talking, a group of us were having dinner with Peter Thiel a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about how when he was at Stanford, one of the young professors was Professor Joe Bankman. And Professor Bankman was telling anybody who would listen that it was really important that the academy diversify and that they shouldn't offer tenure to any more white male professors. And at the time he heard this, he thought, wow, this is very brave in a way. This guy really cares about diversity. He's really putting himself up for these beliefs because he doesn't have tenure yet. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, he got tenure. And in a way, the secret to getting tenure in that moment, if you were a white male academic, was to make clear you were really an ally and say things like this. Now, if you want to get tenure as a legal academic, you probably shouldn't have any associations with the Federal Society. That's probably a bad idea. And you really need to wholeheartedly embrace the sort of mainstream thought at law schools, which unfortunately is increasingly far from the mainstream thought in America or in the judiciary.
Yeah, this is a real problem now that, again, back when I maybe was more engaged with the Federalist Society, yeah, there were some crazy ideas in law schools and at universities at large, but I think we comforted ourselves by saying, well, that's the way the universities are, and they have crazy ideas floating around in them. But now we're getting to that stage where the ideas are now making their way into American society, and that this is the trend in law schools. And so it is important, frankly, to wage the battle here, because the law is almost everything we have, in a way. If that goes, then you're going to have a society you don't want to live in. And I say that with a libertarian audience that probably is very unhappy with much of what passes for American law. But I'm telling you, there's always something worse. And they don't have critical legal studies anymore, which was a more or less Marxist approach to the law. But they don't really have to. They don't really have to openly have something like that, because I think more and more the direction of the faculty and the ideology that's creeping in, it's just taken for granted by everybody that we look at the law in a particular way. We look at the law as an activist would look at it, and not in the restrained way that you're talking about. And this could have very, very bad effects for American society. So you got to fight it. And at the very least, you have to bring in dissident perspectives. And that's what the Federalist Society is doing. So unless you want to jump in on that, we'll head over.
I think it's, you talked about an activist approach to the law. And in fact, Stanford in particular is taking an activist approach to everything. About 5 years ago, the current provost, Bruce Estrell, said to a group of faculty that the thing that Stanford was looking for across its admissions was for the activists of tomorrow. And you think about that, you think about the things that Stanford is excellent in, for example, computer science. And you wonder, well, why would you want the activists of tomorrow? And so this is a very corrosive thing. My suspicion is many of the elite schools beyond Stanford are doing this. And if what you're looking for is activists in law, in medicine, in the hard sciences, you're going to have a very big problem and an increasing loss of confidence for everyday Americans in the people running things like medicine.
Let's talk now about the event, the notorious event. What was the topic and who is Judge Duncan?
Yeah, Judge Kyle Duncan is a very well-regarded judge on the Fifth Circuit. As I imagine your viewers know, as a circuit judge, he sits one level below the Supreme Court. And we try to get a good mix of judges who are longtime friends of our chapter, who are either alumni or have hired a lot of clerks, and people we haven't gotten to hear from very much. And so Judge Duncan is a relatively recent appointee. He was a Trump appointee, and he hasn't visited Stanford before, so we wanted to hear from him. He was coming to speak on Twitter and gun regulation. And the reason we wanted his perspective on that is because a lot of affirmative litigation on the right goes through the Fifth Circuit. So the Fifth Circuit is Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas. If you are a conservative and you want to get a ruling that's sort of in your favor, you tend to file there. Similarly, where we live in California is where you file if you want sort of a left of center ruling. So a lot of the nationwide injunction that stopped the Trump travel ban that came out of the Ninth Circuit. So we wanted to get a perspective from one of the more right-leaning circuits on how affirmative litigation was used on some really controversial and timely issues. And Judge Duncan was the perfect person to have come speak on that.
All right. I guess in a way you've kind of answered that. He's a Trump appointee, which is almost all we need to know. But what is it in particular about his history that would have had so many Stanford students agitated?
Well, I think there's sort of the charitable version and the uncharitable version. So the charitable version, where you think that people really believe the things that they're protesting about or even knew about the substance of the things they were protesting about. Judge Duncan has been on panels or written decisions that were adverse to sort of democratic political aims. So he didn't, for example, create additional representation for Black voters in Louisiana. More fundamentally, the big hook was that he is supposedly transphobic because he refused to use a defendant's pronouns. And we can go into that case more, but at its core, this was a man who had been convicted of sex crime, after conviction, identified as a woman and wanted federal government to use the new preferred female pronouns. And Judge Duncan did not use them, in his opinion, and furthermore said that the federal government did not have to use those preferred pronouns in sort of handling and filings related to this, again, convicted sex offender. The sort of uncharitable version, why I think he was a target, and a number of Trump appointees we've invited here in the past have not been targets in the same way, is that Judge Duncan's like a true believer in a lot of the more conservative things. That's, you know, independent of his role as a judge, but he actually is a person of faith. He has a big family, and he did not go to these sort of elite pedigree schools. He went to Louisiana State, and I think there's a sense that he's not part of the club, right? Like, even if someone's very conservative, if they went to Stanford or Chicago or one of these peer schools, and they had a long career hanging out in DC as a bureaucrat, they're of us. Whereas someone who was really from real America, went to school in real America, did litigation in real America, that person's not worthy of being a judge. And so we can just be incredibly terrible to them.
Isn't it funny how I feel so stupid pointing out this alleged hypocrisy of these people, because it's not really hypocrisy. It's like when I think sometimes we're inclined to think things are hypocrisy, when actually it's just there is actually a rule governing the way they operate. It's whatever advances the revolution is acceptable. There's no hypocrisy involved. That is the way they look at it. Well, likewise, so these people who are supposed to be the paragons of diversity do not seem to have cared one whit about, if you look over the past, 20 or 30 years, how many people sitting on the Supreme Court have come from Harvard Law School or Yale Law School? You know, I mean, overwhelmingly. And that is a complete lack of diversity. So this particular type of person is going to overwhelmingly make decisions for everybody in America? Well, yeah, that's the way some people want it. And these are the ones who tell us, lecture us all day long about democracy and how delicate it is and we have to protect it. But by democracy, what they really mean is people like me are going to tell people like you what to do and you're going to sit there and like it.
Exactly.
So let's talk about what happened. So I saw a clip that I think a lot of people saw, but what happened? I mean, was it he started talking and instantly he couldn't, or what happened actually?
Things started to go off the rails even before he got to the point of being unable to talk. And I think what you're seeing in those videos, these are just students pulling out their phones and taking a video. And I think things got pretty bad before they were like, this is just so weird. I need to pull out my phone. The judge got to the school a bit early. And so he and I went to go grab a coffee. And as we were walking back from the coffee shop towards the campus, we could hear this din. There's just this noise. I'm now told that the school had set up this safe space type thing behind the building the judge was going to speak in. And I assume this was done to sort of de-escalate, but it seems like maybe it functioned more as a pump-up zone. But anyway, when the judge and I got to the building, we walked in and there was this gauntlet of people lining the hallway between where we walked in and the room he needed to go and give a speech. There were about 100 people. People had their faces painted. They had this poodle mix dog that was painted as the trans flag. They were waving these obscene signs at him and sort of getting in his face and yelling at him about various decisions. And so he had to walk this gauntlet just to get in the room. And like most mobs, it fed off itself. So when we got to the front of the hall and we started walking in, we were hearing these sort of middle school like chants, you know, hey, hey, ho, ho, Judge Duncan's got go or something. And by the time we got to the door for the room, things being yelled at him were like, I hope your daughters get raped. Right. I mean, it escalated fast and it was ugly.
That is unbelievable. But by the way, could you imagine if the Federalist Society did something like that to one of their speakers? It would be, we would never, ever hear the end of it.
Well, I don't think I would graduate, right? I mean, and even if I did a lot less, I mean, even if I did something sort of, in my mind, theatrical and clever, like I showed up for a Sonia Sotomayor speech dressed as a fetus and staged a die-in in the front, I would be expelled, right? Like this, you know, and they would say, this was a disruption. You know, it was very triggering. You can't come to school anymore. It is interesting that that is not how things are going on this. But anyway, the judge and I got to the room. I started introducing when I had a paragraph of introduction written, and the noise was already going, right? The booing and the noise. And I just like read through it as if I was in a hostage video and handed off the podium to him and sat down. And so he tried to start on his prepared remarks, and it just wasn't happening. There was a lot of noise, just noise. And then there was this crosstalk. So any word he would say would elicit some sort of response from a particularly boisterous member of the mob. And this went on for more than 10 minutes before anyone intervened. And then the intervention, the sort of unhelpful intervention, is what you see in the tape.
Right. Okay. So one of the arguments that you hear from people who disrupt speeches is that the disruption is also free speech. I mean, it's unbelievable that you could actually be so juvenile as to think that's an argument, but I have heard that raised. I presume you have some kind of answer to that.
Right. I think that there is a line between adding your own speech to the discourse and preventing someone else from speaking. And in fact, Stanford, for all of its flaws, explains this difference in their current policies. And we discussed this on Tuesday. So 2 days before the event, I met with the folks from Student Affairs, and we went over this dividing line. Protest is fine. People were allowed to bring their obscene signs into the event. They were allowed to make their voices heard. They were allowed to put up posters and signs outside the building. There was going to be a Q&A at this event. They were welcome to ask difficult questions. All of that is speech and is fine. But if the way you use your speech is to prevent someone else from speaking, that's considered a disruption and not allowed. And purportedly, Stanford's policy is that you get a warning. Told you're disrupting the speech, you're preventing someone from speaking, and then you are ejected from the event. And you need to have that policy, because if you don't, it effectively silences minority views. You get to the point where a determined majority or just a particularly unhinged group of people can filibuster any speech that they're not excited about.
So what happens then when Dean, now I can't remember her name, I wrote about this in my newsletter.
Yeah, of course. Kieran Steinbach, yeah.
Was it that Judge Duncan, isn't it that he asked for an administrator and this is the one who came forward?
Well, he asked for an administrator and then they had this sort of weird exchange. So she wanders down and says, I'm an administrator. I'm here to respond. And he goes, what? You're here to respond? Because what he's thinking the administrator is going to do is say, this is a disruption. We're going to start ejecting people. Here's the warning.
That's what a normal person would expect, right?
Right, right. And he goes, but she's sort of given something away. She said, you know, I'm here to respond. He goes, well, who are you here to respond to? And she says, well, I'm sure to respond to you and to the room. And he goes, what? And she goes, you're addressing the room. I'm going to address the room. So he's like, okay, on second thought, I'm not sure this is such a good idea. So then she makes this motion at me and she goes, Tim, can I talk? I sort of point back at him and I say, well, that's up to the judge. And then they continue to have this sort of weird thing where he's not quite sold on giving her the podium, but she's asserting that she's a dean. And at the same time, the mob gets involved. And it's this striking thing that people have talked to me and they say, oh, I remember the 60s at Berkeley, there were such bad protests. And it's like, well, you know, the 60s at Berkeley, the mob was solidly against the administration of the school. And here the mob takes her side. If you listen to the tape, the mob says, first, she's a dean, she's an administrator, you asked for an administrator, let her speak. And Judge Duncan sort of seems, it turns out, wisely hesitant to give her the podium, at which point the students start yelling again, sort of more edgy things. You hear somebody yell, your racism is showing. You hear somebody yell, respect black women, respect black women, respect black women, again and again and again. And so when sort of asserting her authority as a dean doesn't work, they move to these identity-based reasons why he has to make space for her. So he's eventually cowed and lets her get behind the podium. And then she whips out this iPad and starts to read from it prepared remarks.
Yeah, which she claims she had just written while she was sitting there.
Well, I'm not sure she claimed that. I mean, has she claimed that on the record? What she said at the time is, I had to write this down because I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah, I had to write this down because so that doesn't necessarily, I took that to mean there's a disruption and everything's chaotic. And so I had to write this down so as to be able to get up here and deliver it effectively. That was what I took it to mean. But maybe she isn't necessarily insisting on that. It doesn't really matter, because if these were prepared remarks from like 3 days earlier, then she's an even less impressive person than you think. I mean, these are your prepared remarks? They're ridiculous. They're what I would expect just any old protester at a fourth-rate school to say. And this is supposed to be a dean. Now, she's a dean in a, let's say, in a technical sense, but she's the dean of, what is it, diversity, equity, and inclusion or something like that?
Right.
So does this not, before we even proceed, does this not seem to suggest, in case we needed it spelled out for us a bit more, that if you were to think that, oh, well, diversity, equity, and inclusion, that sounds nice. It's just that everybody gets a seat at the table and everybody gets a chance to be heard. And so, of course, what could be objectionable about that? That actually, it's none of that. What it really is a power play whereby our perspective is going to be heard and yours might be heard in dribs and drabs if we allow it. But really, this is a power play by which a certain set of ideas will become dominant. That's what these deans are for. Nobody thinks a dean like this is going to insist on improving and even raising the standards at Stanford and make sure everybody is equally heard. No one expects that. We all know that. Am I too cynical?
No, I think one wants to believe that you're too cynical. But in reality, you always end up being exactly correct, that the belonging being created is for a certain set of people. The inclusion is the inclusion of a certain set of people. And it tends not to be actually the people whose voices are minority views at law schools. And so what you saw here was that this job really is to be the adult activist. And so it reports to the most unhinged student. And as long as that person is happy, the university's happy.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. For some reason, it seems like bad publicity is not as important as being perceived as being on the right side of things. So, yes, they have a dean who is going to get them some bad publicity, but they can't not have that dean. That's unthinkable. We'll deal with Tucker Carlson criticizing us from time to time. That's fine. But it was more than just Tucker Carlson. I mean, I don't think Jonathan Turley is an extremist, although I'm sure some of them do. And it was from him that I found out about this whole episode.
I think the branding will certainly keep moving such that within a couple of years, Jonathan Turley will be an extremist. I think the important thing to remember is we invited a sitting, presidentially nominated, Senate-confirmed judge, right? I didn't invite some opinion commentator. I didn't invite someone particularly controversial. And this is what happened.
Yeah.
And so the cynical part of me says, well, my schedule should have been week one, Mila Yiannopoulos, week two, Ann Coulter, week three. And
because what would the difference have been? You know,
right.
Might as well.
Ann Coulter is a tough lady. She can handle it. And we wouldn't have subjected this federal judge to this disgraceful mess.
Well, so go over what it is that she actually told everybody.
So she starts with this therapeutic language of, I had to write this down because I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable because I'm up here. I'm uncomfortable for this speaker who's tearing apart the fabric of this community. And then she turns to the judge and she says, I hope you realize that your words and your actions as a judge are received as violence by people in this room, that it puts them in a state of harm. And then she says, I hope that you have something really important to say, that the juice is worth the squeeze, that all of these horrible things that are descending upon our community are worth it for you to talk about Twitter and guns or whatever you're here to talk about. And at this point, one, between the initial filibuster and her little interlude, we're about halfway through his allotted time. It's supposed to be an hour long event. We're now about halfway through it. So hard to say that he's now really getting a chance to speak since he had prepared an hour long speech with Q&A and now half that time is gone. And second, the tone of free speech is not really free when you have someone invoking the power of the university, shaming the speaker and critiquing them in advance of their ability to speak. It was just a very weird thing.
So how does it end? How does the event end? She leaves the room to cheers.
She leaves the podium and the situation isn't really fixed immediately. There's still a lot of tenseness. There's still a lot of noise. He still can't really give his speech. And then she has this sidekick who's this guy who apparently is from the Maine University. I'd never met him before, but he works in student affairs somewhere. And he wanders up to the leader of the mob, a student, and they have some sort of exchange. At which point that student stands up and says, okay, I want half of you to leave the room in protest. I want the other half of you to stay here for the Q&A.
And tone down the heckling a little bit.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so half the students get up and they leave. And that does change the ratio in the room, right? So that it's not such an overwhelming majority of people are there to be part of this mob. There are now a more equal number of people who are here to talk about gun control, people who are here to yell about rape or whatever. So this is probably good. And there is a bit less heckling. But by that point, we solidly are halfway through the time. And so he says, fine, let's just go into Q&A. And so he goes into Q&A and he gets a number of kind of bad faith or very personal questions, including getting into it with this guy with the sign. I don't know, am I allowed to say bad words on the podcast or are we?
Well, if they're really bad, we'll bleep them out.
Okay,
just for the kids whose parents are listening.
Right. So one student has a sign and is waving it like he's in front of a check cashing store or something. He's like throwing the sign around and it says, Kyle Duncan can't find the clit. And so Judge Duncan sort of points him and says, what does that even mean? And the kid says, oh, you know what it means. I'm a gay man. I f*** men. I can find the prostate. Why can't you find the clit? And this is sort of one of the more memorable, but not really an outlier in the exchanges he's having in this supposed scholarly Q&A. And the room gets tenser, and you can tell it's not heading in a good direction, at which point the event is called, and two federal marshals take him and me out of the building, and they put him in a car and drive off.
That is unbelievable. That is unbelievable. I mean, I use the word savage somewhat liberally, I admit, but I don't know how else to describe people who act this way and who speak that way to another human being. But now, okay, after this all passes, because of the technology available to us where anybody has a video camera, we all saw this particular clip. And then it did start getting media attention. Well, I think even before, or at least maybe simultaneous with the media attention, you have another dean who made some kind of statement indicating that they're going to look into it, but what transpired here is not consistent with our views on free speech. And I believe even hinted that the way the quote-unquote dean handled it was also unacceptable. And then this dean, in turn, has been protested since then because she had this crazy idea that when a guest is at your event, you let the person speak, you know, wild radicalism she had in her head. Can you fill in the blanks of what I just said?
Absolutely. So this event happened on a Thursday, and the media started to pick it up. There started to be murmurs of it on Twitter that night. And by Friday, you were seeing it pop up a lot of places on Twitter, in some reporting. Over the weekend, the dean and the president of the university, so the dean, like the dean of the law school, the real dean, and the president of Stanford, so her boss, send out this joint apology where they apologize to the judge. They clarify that this was a disruption, not protected speech, which was important because during the event, one of the administrators actually, you can hear on the tape saying, oh, well, this is just speech. This isn't a disruption. And you're like, well, what would be a disruption? Lighting the dais on fire? I mean,
Yeah. If this isn't one, yeah.
So this sort of clarified that this had, in fact, been a disruption. And they say that the intervention by Dean Steinbach probably wasn't in line with the school's policies on free speech. So an important first step, but one that only comes because of media attention and pressure about 48 hours after this thing goes down, I think a little more than that. And one that sounds somewhat strong, but is mainly operating in platitude, right? Like, this won't happen again. Well, I mean, who's to say this won't happen again? You know, we're looking into it, looking into our policies, but the policies aren't really the problem. And sort of telegraphing that nobody's really going to be held responsible, right? That there won't be serious consequences either for the mob or for these administrators. And then, as you said, this appropriate but not particularly tough apology then gets all kinds of negative flack. So one of the groups that helped plan the original mob, the National Lawyers Guild, sends out this email to the student body saying, this was Stanford Law at its best. We think this was handled very well, and we hope you'll join us in speaking truth to power and holding people accountable in the future. So that goes out. The Human Rights Club sends out a similar email. The American Constitution Society, another leftist-centered group, similarly comes out in favor of Dean Steinbach and sort of asserts that nothing really wrong happened. So you have the student groups sort of lining up, totally unrepentant, the people who were in this mob saying, we'll do it again. And then on Monday, the dean, Dean Martinez, still teaches. So she teaches one section of con law every year. And so that class ends up being protested. The vast majority of her students wear all black. They have this protest of her class. And then they gauntlet her as she's leaving the room. And so it doesn't seem like there's even fake contrition on the part of the people who formed this mob. And it isn't clear that Stanford plans to do anything significant. I think they just hope it goes away.
And that's the end of the story? That's where things stand now?
That's where things stand now. I'm told that there's going to be a committee on free speech. I hear from some of the faculty in the main university that they already have, before this event, they had agreed to form a committee on free speech, but that it is held up in the committee on committees and that it has not been.
Is that not bureaucracy in a nutshell?
Oh, it really is. I mean, this is what happens when your school is like $40 billion plus hashtag innovation, and you just are a big bureaucracy with a lot of money. So they're supposedly thinking about free speech, but unclear that they're going to do much. It doesn't seem that anyone will suffer any real consequences. And a lot of the people who have agreed to come visit the Federalist Society in the spring, a number of other judges, are calling me and saying, is this going to happen to me? I like the idea of coming and speaking at Stanford, and I like the idea of meeting with some of your students and hiring clerks, but I don't like the idea so much that I want to do whatever that was. And so I'm really grateful no one has officially canceled yet, but a number of people are really questioning whether this is something they're interested in doing.
Obviously, I know what you would like to see the university do. Is there anything at all, given that the real minority on the Stanford campus is people like you, obviously, because I guarantee you that the various victim groups who we are told are the marginalized people in society, they're so marginalized that they can, without consequence, shout down anybody they like and know for a fact that if they bring a speaker, absolutely nothing will happen to that person. That's the opposite of being marginalized. You guys are marginalized. Is there anything you can do about this?
Well, I don't think you can just accept. I think a lot of people on the right are sort of inclined to say, well, the elite universities are lost. And again, Stanford has $40 billion. A lot of these schools have just a ton of money. It's not an acceptable solution to say we're going to create our own universities or we're going to teach all of our children to be HVAC technicians, and that's a good middle-class life, because we need to have some representation in the professions. We can't just sort of let these become pieces of the left. I think you have to fight very hard. You have to hope that there's something redeemable at these schools. But I think there's two prongs. The first one is the sort of policy and administrative one, where you say we need to enforce some sort of consequences for the guilty, and we need to think about how the power levers at the university can be arrayed in a way that protects free speech and dialogue and things like that. The other thing you have to work on is, even if I had brought Satan as a guest speaker, there should be people yelling that they hope that his children will be raped. I mean, there's something sort of deeply disordered and culturally sick in a place where that is the level of dialogue and the way people treat each other. And so I'm not sure what the answer is to reset so there's less contempt and hatred. But being a evangelical Christian, I've got to think prayer is part of it, and that there's some role for people of faith to play in sort of changing hearts and minds.
Well, I hate to leave on a kind of an ambiguous or even a discouraging note, but I don't know what we can do other than publicize stuff like this. But then we publicize it, and in a way, it's going to make things worse at Stanford, because it'll drive away more of the people who would bring genuine diversity to Stanford, and it'll attract more of the sort of person who cannot bear to hear his ideas challenged, which is a deeply and profoundly juvenile way to go through life, but it's the way they've chosen. I wish we had something better to end with.
I'm not totally sure I accept the premise of that first point, that this is going to drive people away from Stanford who we need. I think that maybe we just need to be a bit more honest with people, that there's still something very worthwhile. If you're someone of faith or a person who's conservative, we still need you to go to these elite spaces. We need you to get the training that they offer insofar as it has any value. But we also just need you to be there and sort of keep the light going. And it's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be a fun time. It's not going to be a safe space. But maybe you're called to something more than that. Maybe this is a way that you can do something of value at a very young age. And so you will get a different experience and a richer training than your peers on the left. You will form a smaller cohort of friends, but really deep friendships that are going to stick with you for the rest of your life. And you're going to have the opportunity to make a difference in our society that you might not find if you hide out at Hillsdale. So please come to Stanford, fight the fight. There's an alumni network that is small but mighty and will back you, and we need you.
Wow, that's a good appeal. That's a good appeal. And I, as much as anybody, think that in cases where it's feasible, it may be necessary to create parallel institutions. But in terms of creating an entirely new network of law schools, I don't know if that's doable or if we have enough time to do it. So it may genuinely be the case that there is no substitute for rolling up your sleeves and getting in there and fighting. Because as I say, if a certain philosophy of law spreads further than it has already, we're all going to be very sorry. And so maybe exactly the strategy that you're recommending is the correct way forward. Well, is there any link or anything you want me to tell people about if they want to follow you more, or maybe know about the Federalist Society or anything like that? Any link you want to share, let us know what it is.
Oh, I think the Federalist Society has a great program, their Freedom of Thought Initiative. I think they're doing really important work across law schools. So folks who are interested in this in a theoretical sense should go there, particularly for your young listeners who are thinking about law school, thinking about where they want to go. I would love for them to follow me on Twitter at TimJRJR. Just message me. I'd love to talk through what you're thinking about in terms of law school and where you might want to go and how you can survive and thrive in a place that might seem hostile. But of course, I'm happy to hear from everyone. So anyone who would like to contact me there, I will respond to.
Tim, thank you very much and best of luck to you.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.